You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France, in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we are in Romans-sur-Isère.
Yeah, boys.
Where are we, Lionel?
Where are we, Richard? We're on the banks of the Isère River at Granges-les-Beaumont, not far from where stage 16 of the Tour de France finished in Romans-sur-Isère. This is a lovely spot. We could have done with this on the rest day.
This is a lovely spot. It's beautiful here, and you can probably hear the crickets. Francois was saying it's a sign that we're close to Provence. We got a bit of a fright today seeing a signpost for Chambéry. We were there just over a week ago. But Lionel, we were played in there by some frantic sounding reaction on the finish line. You captured that.
Well, that was Michael Matthews celebrating winning his second stage of the Tour de France and Team Sunweb's third. And he was absolutely delighted at the finish. You could hear him. He was actually shouting into the radio to tell his teammates that he got the verdict in the sprint finish. Another near miss for Edvald Boasenhagen, who was second, and John Degenkolb, who was third. And the German wasn't very happy, was he? He lashed out a little bit at Matthews, thinking that the Australian veered across the road towards him a little bit.
The German was not very happy indeed. It's the third occasion I've seen Degenkolb, ride furiously back to his bus in quite a temper. 2015, at the end of the cobbled stage that Tony Martin won, he was very angry that day with, funnily enough, Warren Barguil, who was then his teammate at Giant Alpecin. Barguil today was instrumental in setting up the win for Michael Matthews. Degenkolb also last year in Bern in Switzerland was really angry and gave me a very bad tempered interview at the finish. He's got quite a temper on him. We can hear from him now, actually. Shall we hear from John Degenkolb? We got a bit of reaction from him at the finish. Here he is.
To launch a sprint at 200 metres, and I start the sprint, and clearly came with more speed than him from his wheel, and he saw me on the right side and closed the gap on the right side, and that made me stop the sprint to sprint for the victory. Our TV didn't work, so I haven't seen it so far, clearly. It's just like in the heat of the situation, you are obviously very angry if you cannot go for the victory, and if you know you have the legs to overtake him, and that's very disappointing. For me, it's very clear. You see, he is going off his line into my line, and you can see it on television.
So that was John Degenkolb, and there was footage of him lashing out at Michael Matthews. Michael Matthews said he grabbed him by the neck and that the officials saw it, and it sounded to me like he was not very happy about that. But as we speak, an hour or so after the finish, there's been no word on any sort of punishment for John Degenkolb. Marcel Kittel was punished today for swearing at the race jury, apparently. I'm not sure what that was about. We're doing things in a slightly different order.
The wind.
It's the rest day that's thrown us a little bit. I forgot your tale of the tap, Lionel. Give us a tale of the tap.
How very dare you? Stage 16.
We're fluid.
From Le Puy-en-Velay to Romans-sur-Isère. Only 165 kilometres. As we've already said, Michael Matthews won. John Degenkolb not very happy. Edvald Boasenhagen close by a whisker again. But the other story of the day is that the wind did blow in the latter stages. And there were a few people who missed out when the split started to happen. Most notably Dan Martin, who lost 51 seconds, having taken 2 or 3 days to gain about that much. He's lost it all again in one afternoon, or not even one afternoon, one half hour. And really, that was capped a pretty bad day for Quickstep, because Philippe Gilbert didn't start the stage this morning. He has a stomach problem. They badly missed him today. Marcel Kittel, who's wearing the green jersey, was dropped early on and finished many minutes down. And Quickstep really put all of their troops with Kittel rather than with Martin. Martin wasn't the only one to lose out in those splits. Louis Menkes also lost 51 seconds. Alberto Contador lost a minute and 33. Nairo Quintana did make the split, so he's back into the top 10. In terms of the green jersey, Matthews won the intermediate sprint and the stage to cut Kittel's lead by 50 points. and the German now leads by only 29 points. And with an intermediate sprint coming after a second category climb tomorrow, there's a great chance for Matthews to trim that lead even further. Chris Froome still in yellow, of course. He leads Fabio Aru by 18 seconds, with Bardet third and Uran fourth. No change there, other than Mikel Landa and Simon Yates both move up a slot because Martin has slipped from fifth to seventh. Warren Barguil still in King of the Mountains. Simon Yates still in the white jersey. And tomorrow we go into the Alps with the Quad Affair, the Telegraph and the Galibier for the first time since 2011. One last little bit of news is that George Bennett, the Kiwi rider who'd been doing so well, he's also pulled out of the race, abandoning on the road today. So a real shame for him.
A real shame. A real star of this tour. He's ridden well and gave us fantastic interviews as well. So hope to see him back soon. I think that the big surprise today, I mean, Sunweb executed a fantastic plan. They took it on in the way it was 160-odd kilometres, but in actual fact, it was a 3.5-hour stage, and it was ridden full gas, as they say, pretty much like the stage in Tofoire was ridden a few days ago, very, very aggressively from the gun. There was a game plan there. Quick Step did put a lot of bodies around Marcel Kittel and did leave Dan Martin a little bit isolated. He had Gianluca Brambilla and Jack Bauer. Of the two, Bauer quite useful, but there were some, you know, Julian Vermaat, Zdenek Stibar behind as well, who would have been useful allies for Martin in the crosswinds.
Yes, Quick Step really, well, a bad decision, but as Brian Holm said, and we're going to listen to him in a moment, but he said that's cycling, and that's also hard luck. They lost Gilbert in the morning, they already lost Matteo Trentin, who was crucial in this kind of stages, so probably the best two riders in this kind of situations were missing. They, to lesser consequences, they made the same blunder as the FDJ did, you know, last week with Arnaud Démare, you know, putting all their reserves on one guy, and well, in a way, what a guy, you know, green jersey holder, five stage winner. Five-stage winner, we can understand why they put so much emphasis, because, you know, he probably will be the favorite for the Champs-Élysées stage. He might, you know, go all the way with the green jersey. You can understand why they made the decision. And the problem is everybody knew there would be, you know, split or an echelon in the finale with the win. You know, everybody knew at the start. Everybody was talking when, you know, I called a few directeurs sportifs this morning. From the car, they were all talking about the wind, so they knew that crosswinds were scheduled. In a sense, Quickstep should have anticipated that and probably, you know, made sure Martin had a solid rider with him. That's what, you know, Brian Holm said. He said, well, our master plan just didn't work. The problem is, what was their master plan, you know? They probably didn't anticipate losing Gilbert. They probably did not anticipate Kittel being dropped so early. And they probably didn't anticipate Dan Martin having this problem. We don't exactly know what happened. He was apparently just dropped. But Brian Holm even hinted that there might have been a crash. In any case, after a brilliant, almost perfect start to the Tour de France, today was Quickstep's bad day.
But the thing about Quickstep is they're one of the only teams who have got such big dual objectives. So they've lost two riders and they've got to try and man their resources across helping Dan Martin and helping Marcel Kittel. There are other teams that are, you know, going for, you know, perhaps stage wins and protecting a place in and around the top 10 of the GC. But actually going for the podium with Dan Martin and the green jersey and stage win with Marcel Kittel, Quickstep are one of the strongest, if not the strongest team in the world. And yet, even they were stretched a bit too thin today, where you would normally think, well, crosswinds, they're going to be absolutely home and hosed here because this is their territory. This is where, well, we were saying this morning, weren't we? This is where Quickstep could really make some advantage for Dan Martin. And had Kittel not been caught out early on and then been behind, if he'd been safely just having a relatively easy ride with the other sprinters until the last phase, we might well have seen Quickstep on the front foot rather than on the back foot.
That says a lot about, you know, this possibility we heard many times of reducing the teams to eight in future Grand Tours, because it would, as we saw today, it would make life much more difficult for, you know, big outfits to actually have two goals in the same Grand Tour. So, you know, so food for thought about that. and really a pity for Dan Martin, because we really must admire, you know, that rider. I mean, he had this horrific crash with Richie Porte on the road to Chambéry. He survived it. He managed to, you know, waste as much time as possible, and then he worked so hard to gain this time back, and, you know, fight his way back to contention, to the top five. And, you know, to lose it the way he did today is really, how could I say, it's very frustrating, even for us, you know, because you have to admire all the efforts he made, and you know, to lose all this time, because just at that very moment, for just 10, 20, 15 minutes, he doesn't have a teammate around him, is a bit frustrating.
Well, we'll hear what happened with Dan Martin in part two with another interview, but you spoke to Brian Holm at the finish, Francois, so let's hear from Brian Holm now, the Quick Step sports director.
How disappointing was it today to see Dan after all the great work he'd done so far?
First, I have to hear how he lost it. If it was due to the crash, he lost the wheel. Maybe there was a crash, I don't know who went down. It was due to the crash, I mean, that's cycling, yeah. I still feel more pity for him when he crashed to Chambéry, losing 1:20. That was painful. That's cycling, we have to live with it.
Was it difficult today for Quick Step to have several goals to defend? Marcel on the one hand, Dan on the other hand?
Of course, it would have been more easy with Gilbert in. It would have been much more easy with Matteo in for Dan also. But when people get sick and crashing, we can't really do much about it. And we just have to sort of follow, hope for the best. And today, our master plan didn't work out today. And what the real excuses is, I have to ask Dan about. So, the cycling, of course, we're disappointed, but not like Chambéry disappointed. If that's the top 10 scale on disappointment, then we're just on 6 or 7 today, if you know what I'm saying.
We're back to the mountains tomorrow. Normally, you know, Dan is back on his terrain, so what to expect?
Oh, then we hope for no crosswind, because he's not going to have many teammates to protect him.
And how about Marcel?
And then I hope for Diamond's legs.
And how about Marcel? Do you fear that with the stages to come, that Michael may have a little advantage on the intermediate sprint?
I fear and fear. I mean, if you do it, if you win it, then you win it. Then we say congratulations in Paris cycling, isn't it? I mean, you can win like Sagan the other years. He was faster, he was better in the media than his winning. It's nothing to do with luck, simply because he's better, you know. And that can really not make us stay asleep. We still won 5 stages, didn't we? I know it's a long time ago, but we're still happy about it. We're not really depressed. I know we would like to hear it, but we're not. We're still surviving. We're still hanging on.
Hi, I'm Joey Early. I'm the cafe manager in the Rafa Boulder Clubhouse, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to Rafa, our wonderful sponsor, and thank you to all of you who have been buying Rafa Cycling Podcast clothing, the Pedaleur de Charme jersey and t-shirt and cap. You've been posting some pictures on social media. It's great to see it out and about there. Rigoberto Urán has been presented with his Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. I'm still waiting for the photograph of that seminal moment.
So if the Cannondale PR man Matt Bowden could just get on with that, that would be great.
Thanks.
I know they've got other things on their mind at the moment. They're trying to win the Tour de France.
It's all on his plate.
Get their priorities.
Come on,
right.
Matt. Anyway, we heard from Brian Holm at the end of the last part, and it was quite interesting because he obviously hadn't spoken to Dan Martin yet, didn't know exactly what had happened. Lionel, you spoke to Oliver Nassen, the Belgian champion, rides for AG2R.
I did, waited quite a long time for him at the finish line because he was in a lot of demand from the Belgian media. There was the Flemish-speaking media. Sportsa have both video and radio, and they're both live, and they both take precedent, and they push in.
Dutch and Belgian riders are very difficult to speak to sometimes, aren't they?
In Belgium, they're worse because they usually speak Dutch in the first place, then they speak French a little bit, and by the time you manage to get them.
Well, and then the French-speaking Belgians came in as well, and of course, Nassen speaks both Flemish and French.
But
and
you were wearing something that caught his attention.
I was wearing a Trainer Road hat from given to us as a gift by our sponsors last year, Trainer Road, and Oliver Narsen uses Trainer Road for his training. And he actually said, oh, do you work for Trainer Road? And I said, no, we used to be sponsored by them. After he'd done all of his 45 Belgian TV interviews, he waited even longer, even though he'd finished his drink and I could tell he was thirsty and wanted to get back to the bus. But he answered a few questions in English for us. How nerve-wracking was it out there with the wind?
First of all, the stage was 165 km long, and we knew it from the briefing there was only there were two very dangerous moments. The first one where nothing happened, and the second one where everything happened. So it wasn't that nerve-wracking during the day, but there's this one point in the final where everybody knows we have to be in the front. It's there, everything's going to happen there, and that's pretty nerve-wracking, yeah, for sure.
Great for Romain Bardet to have a Belgian champion on the team. You must know all about the crosswinds.
It's a bit of a... It's one of the only things I can do on this tour, so I'm happy I was here for him, and it was very important for the team and for him to have us, to have both of us in the front, especially him. And I think we should be really happy this is over.
How quickly did you know that Dan Martin wasn't in the group, for example?
He was right in front of me when he left the gap, so I was the first to see.
And so at that point, it was just full gas?
Yeah, when somebody leaves the gap, it's only 2 meters you're behind the group. But then another guy leaves the gap, another guy leaves the gap, and it all, some meters you have to bridge. But when everybody has full gas, those meters are very, very expensive and hard ones. But I'm really happy we closed them, and we got to the finish in time.
All down to Trainer Road.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the men of the day, I think, Oliver Narsen, because, I mean, he's being very self-deprecating there, saying that riding in crosswinds is the only thing he can do. I think that's selling himself a little bit short, because he is the Belgian champion and he's very strong. But Romain Bardet said today that Narsen saved his life, because, well, we heard him say there Dan Martin was the guy who let a 2 metre gap open.
That was fascinating, because that's in the crosswinds, these splits happen just because one rider can't quite hold the wheel. And as he said there, a 1 meter, 2 meter split can rapidly become an unbridgeable gap. And fascinating to hear him say that it was actually Dan Martin who let the wheel in front of him go. And that's where he needed an Oliver Narsen, a strong rider, riders around him, just to, you know, prevent those gaps from opening.
Well, the interesting thing is when you think about it, you wonder, well, why can't Dan Martin get on Romain Bardet's wheel and exploit Oliver Narsen's hard work? But it doesn't even work like that, does it? Because when the wind is coming from one side, basically you run out of road. And so Oliver Narsen's not going to ride, you know, if the wind's coming off the left, he's not going to ride right out in the middle of the road. He's going to just give enough shelter for his man, Romain Bardet, which means that then there's not enough shelter for the next man, and that's when it becomes so hard to hold that wheel. And then once the wind gets in between and that gap becomes 1 meter, suddenly it's 2 meters, suddenly it's 5 meters, suddenly it's 50
seconds. It's like losing a wheel on a climb, basically.
Yeah. And if you can't hold it, you know, you can't reproach the rider for anything, really. I mean, it's just, you could say, well, you could be further forward at the critical moment, but once the wind's having its say, it's very hard. You don't win against the wind, especially when you're Dan Martin's size.
That's a great explanation of what an echelon is. I mean, you know, very often we have to have that explanation again, you know, of what an echelon is and why, when the wind blows, all of a sudden we have the riders, instead of, you know, riding in a line, start to ride in a kind of awkward oblique fashion, like making these kind of waves or pyramidal forms or around the road. Well, it's precisely for what Lionel you just explained, you know. Try to cover your man from the wind, and so actually the riders take the direction of the wind like sunflowers, you know, take the direction of the sun in the summer. It's a little bit the same thing, you know, everybody pointing the same way. And it was again, you know, a fine illustration of how tricky the windy stages are. And you know, let's be very careful about what the next couple of stages, because at the start, before we get to the mountains, when the Mistral, because this is the wind that's blowing in the Rhone Valley, when the Mistral starts to blow, like we saw last year on the Ventoux, it can be very damaging at the beginning of the stages and create splits early on, you know, favoring breakaways. And if it goes on until Marseille, we could have a very interesting time trial in Marseille, because with that kind of wind, you know, on a time trial that for the two-thirds is held by the sea could have an impact on the results.
So does this wind basically just blow all the way from here down to the sea?
It does, yeah.
So the stage on Friday that we're all thinking, well, that could be just fairly benign, actually could be more of the same.
If the Mistral doesn't stop, usually from my experience, the Mistral blows for 2 or 3 days, but that's, I said usually, because last year, remember, it actually blew for like a week, you know. So it's a factor to be taken into account. Well, probably less, you know, in the next couple of stages in the mountains, in the Alps. But when we're back in the valley to Salon de Provence, and then in the time trial, it could be a factor.
Well, we've talked about a bad day for Quickstep, a good day for Romain Bardet and AG2R, because this, again, a potentially very difficult day for Bardet. We expected Fabio Aru to have problems today, but seemed to cope okay with it. Chris Froome was the rider least likely to have problems, perhaps, of all those GC contenders, along with Rigoberto Urán. They were all together. But really, the team of the day, and the team that made the stage and won the race in the end, and, you know, Edvald Boasenhagen, a lot of sympathy for him because he's gone so close and went very close again. Michael Matthews did certainly move towards the right, just closing the door in Degenkolb. I don't think he veered. I don't think he switched dramatically, but he did move to the right and just made it harder, made it further for Degenkolb to come round. He won the stage, and nobody could argue that he didn't deserve it on the basis of the phenomenal work done by his team all day.
No, it was an amazing performance by Team Sunweb. I mean, they've been amazing since the start of this tour. They're riding differently on this. I mean, they won the Giro, let's not forget that. But they rode a very different race in the Giro because they were going for the GC. And in this Tour de France, they all said the same thing. Warren Barguil is in the polka dot jersey, said how much he's having fun. He rides the way he likes to ride, going for stages, going for climbs, going to the offensive. That's what he likes to do. And that it's actually what Michael Matthews is saying as well, that he is having great fun on the tour for once, because let's, you know, remember that in last year he won the stage for the first time, but in the previous tours he had a terrible crash with the Orica team 2 years ago. It was really an ordeal for him all the way. He managed to finish, which was amazing given the injuries he had. And the year before, he just didn't make the start. He crashed the day before. So for him, the tour so far had been kind of a problem. He won stages in every other Grand Tours. He held the leader's jersey in all the other Grand Tours. And now, he said it yesterday, actually, after the before the rest day. He said, you know, he was enjoying himself. The tour was not difficult for him. He just had to deliver on the couple of stages he had targeted. And today, as Luke Roberts said, you know, the team director said to a few journalists, including me, they actually in the bus, you know, thought about 100 scenarios, he said, and, you know, going from number 1 to number 2, 3, 4, because there were so many, you know, different possibilities today. And he said, well, but there was one plan, you know, and that plan was to isolate Kittel and then go for stage win try to eliminate a few other riders in a split and then go for the stage win with Michael Matthews. That was that was plan number 1. But I mean, you know, to execute such a plan so perfectly, well, I mean, you know, it's just amazing. And the reason why they did it, he said, was because, you know, that there is this you know, comradeship during in the team, real friendship. They're just having fun, you know. And very often in sports, that's the key: have fun.
Should we listen to hear a bit of Luke Roberts now?
Absolutely.
Here he is.
Didn't expect the team to ride from beginning to end in the front and drop him off for the sprint the whole way. It was an awesome job by the team. That was really super strong from all of them, and I'm really happy that Michael could finish it off. We knew it was going to be a hard start. We knew it would be a possibility that Michael could have distanced Kittel, and possibly today was a day to bounce back a bit in the green jersey competition. But knowing that he was dropped in that 30 rider group, and, you know, gave Michael a better chance, also gave other sprint teams a bit of a sniff of a victory, knowing Kittel wouldn't be there for the bunch sprint. So yeah, it was a hard day for our guys. They really had to work for it, but yeah, it was also a stressful bunch today with the wind the way it was. So yeah, I'm happy our guys could control it the way they did, and it was really a fantastic job. Not racing for the GC here, we just go out to win each day. And we can't really lose. either we win or we try again the next day. So nice to be able to race aggressive like that, not have this pressure and extra stress of the GC. The boys are loving it. Always plan to keep a focus on the green jersey. We still haven't lost sight of that. We'll still keep the pressure on. We still have a few more days where we can pick up some points, and then we'll see how it unfolds in Paris. But
intermediate sprint ahead look more favourable to Michael than they are to Marcel, so that's probably the key for the green jersey.
Yeah, exactly. In the days to come, there can be moments where we can pick up points where it's going to be more difficult for Marcel to pick up points. You know, Friday's again a stage where there's a question mark over the stage. Is it a breakaway stage? Is it a sprint stage? Is it difficult enough? It's a long stage, so that could be a spanner in the works on Friday. But with the pure sprint on the straight up sprint on the Champs-Élysées, Marcel is going to be a favourite there. So we'd need to have a pretty good lead to make sure we could hang on to it should we come into Paris in green.
You said you had no pressure this morning, but actually everybody was kind of expecting you to ride the race you did today, and you did it.
Yeah, I mean, people saying, "What now? Just drop Kittel on the first climb, ride a team time trial at the finish." I sort of laughed and said, "Yeah, we could try that," but and we did it.
The thing is, with Michael Matthews winning that stage and also winning the intermediate sprint, all of a sudden the green jersey competition is alive again. I wouldn't say that the pendulum has swung Michael Matthews' way yet, because the gap is still 29 points, and Kittel will be certainly the favourite on the Champs-Élysées. And if Friday's stage turns out to be a bunch sprint, he'll be the favourite there. But if Michael Matthews can get intermediate sprints in the next two mountain stages, and tomorrow is definitely a possibility, and you would expect Sunweb to be aggressive from the start, try and get Matthews over the top of that first climb, the second category climb, in a break, or at least towards the front, so that he can win maximum points there. Suddenly there's a race on, and that competition looked like it was absolutely sewn up by Kittel, that all he had to do was fall over the line in Paris, and now that might not be the case.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport, who sponsor the Cycling Podcast. A reminder that they're running a competition in conjunction with us. Go to sciencesport.com/thecyclingpodcast. Incredible prize is worth over £15,000. Go to that website that I just mentioned to enter and stand a chance of winning. There's some great prizes. Any other business from today? Well, I spoke at the finish. A couple of you have asked us about Esteban Chavez, who at the start of the year was being talked about as a Tour de France contender. He obviously had a brilliant season last year, and he's had a really difficult year. He finished second in the Tour de l'Under at the start of the year, but then suffered an injury that kept him out for a while. And at the start of the Tour, a terrible tragedy. His physiotherapist was killed in a car accident, and he was very close to her. And in fact, she was going to go and work with the team at the Vuelta this year. So that has affected him badly, and he's been getting through the Tour. I spoke to him briefly at the finish, and I spoke to the Orica Scott sports director Matt White, whose rider Simon Yates did well today, finished with that front group, and moved ahead of Dan Martin, I think, overall. So a good day for him, and it's a good Tour for him. Here is Esteban Chavez first, and then Matt White. You've obviously had a disappointing season, missed a lot of this season with injury, but you're here in the third week of the Tour. How are you feeling at the moment?
I'm tired. I'm not disappointed, never. We are humans, you know. Sometimes it's really good, sometimes it's really bad. But in the difficult moments is when the real champions come in.
Do you feel as the Tour goes on that you're getting better?
Oh, I don't know. I'm tired now, and we have one goal, is keep Simon Yates in the white jersey until Paris.
And then after this, what's next for you? Will you go to the Vuelta?
I will rest, for sure. It's a little bit holidays, and we will see what is after.
Are you enjoying supporting Simon in this race?
A lot.
I guess today was a potential banana skin for Simon, all the GC riders.
Yeah.
Did you anticipate that at the start of the day?
100%. We have weather apps. Yeah, we did, mate. It was always going to be a stressful day today. Some guys also react a little bit different off the back of a rest day. But we had full confidence in the guys we've got there to look after Simon, and they certainly did an incredible job.
I mean, Simon is a small, lightly built climber, but he handles himself pretty well in those sort of situations, doesn't he?
Certainly does. He was world point score champion, so he can handle his bike. And then when you put a couple of big strong guys around him, he was never in any threat today.
Are you pleased with the way he's riding? We know him as a quite aggressive attacking rider. He obviously won a stage at the Vuelta last year.
Yeah.
He seems to be riding squarely for GC here.
Oh, 100%. Couldn't be more excited about how he's gone. It's his first Tour de France riding for general classification. And we're getting closer, and we're eliminating guys one at a time, and things are going in the right direction.
And you're happy with Esteban as well. He obviously has had a disappointing year, but how's he coping as the race goes into the
third
week?
Well, he hasn't had a disappointing year. He was second at Tour Down Under. What he's had is he's had some setbacks. Two big setbacks. One, he's had the injury, and then he's obviously had the death of a very close friend on the Tour de France. So I wouldn't be too judgmental about where Esteban is, and he's going to use this as a big preparation to try to win the Tour of Spain in a month's time.
Whitey setting you straight there a bit, Richard.
I should have said difficult rather than disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't choose
my words very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, we knew Chavez had had a difficult first half of the year, wasn't going to come here as a GC contender, really riding this as preparation for the Vuelta.
Which Matt White says he wants to, you know, he thinks he can win.
Well, I mean, they've got an embarrassment of riches, haven't they, with three consistent riders. When you think about Simon Yates and Adam Yates, I mean, Adam Yates rode around the Tour last year like it was, you know, just what he does every July and has done for years, won the white jersey.
Fourth
overall. He then rode, well, then Simon Yates rode very well at the Vuelta in a really difficult final week there. Then at the Giro, Adam Yates rode fantastically well, finished in the top 10. And now Simon Yates is on course for the top 10 here. Could even make a few gains in the next couple of days, you never know. And his time trialing, which has been the one thing that you look at both of the Yates brothers and think, well, that's their weakness. Actually, that's not proving to be the case, because Simon Yates was very good in Dusseldorf. In fact, only Chris Froome, really, of the top 10 was better than him, I think. And so when you look at the possibilities for Orica, not just at the Vuelta, but at all three Grand Tours next year, I mean, depending on what a fantastic set of cards to play when sitting down at the start of a year and thinking, well, who are we going to put in each race? Let's weigh up the course, see which course suits which rider the best. Adam and Simon Yates have got slightly different strengths. I think Adam is probably the better bet for a really mountainous Giro or Tour or Vuelta, whereas Simon Yates is a kind of a stayer, isn't he? And as Matt White said there, even though he's only, well, he's, what is he, 10 stone dripping wet, he still manages to fight because he's a track rider, really. He won a World Points Championship on the track. You know, when it gets grippy and gnarly and difficult in the wind there, you would think, well, he might be vulnerable, but not the case at all today.
When you look at both of them, oddly enough, Adam is probably the one best suited so far to go for great placings in the GC, whereas Simon has a couple of stage wins on Grand Tours, which Adam hasn't got yet. They are twin brothers. Their paths look very closely linked, but they have their you know, differences, and which I think that suits them very well, because they've had to face so many, many questions about, you know, the being twin brother, that now actually we see the differences. And as you say, Orica, I mean, you have three, for years and years that they've been a great team, but going for sprints, yellow jerseys, team time trials, and they had never had really a GC contender. Now, as you say, they are three very different riders, roughly the same age, coming of age, quickly. One of them will probably win a Grand Tour.
I mean, Simon Yates is quite. I mentioned to Matt White, he is an attacking rider. I've seen win stage at the Vuelta last year, obviously, and he has been riding slightly a la Zubeldia in this year's Tour.
I don't know about that, because
he went on the attack the other day. Yeah, but I think it's a learning experience for him, and I think it's about learning his limits. And you'll often see him. Louis Menke's talked as well in today's excellent Kilometre Zero, by the way, the African Challenge, about where you sit in that group of GC contenders. I thought that was really interesting how Louis Menke's explained why he sits off in last man. Simon Yates does a similar thing, and that's just the way he rides, and Adam Yates rides the same way, but it's interesting.
Can I reprise my joke about the Yates twins, and perhaps in future they might alternate one day.
Twin, or twin
pick,
doping.
Pick the best. Yeah, exactly. I mean, every day we get the communique from the Tour de France, which explains how many bikes have been scanned from hidden motors by the UCI jury. I wonder if in 2 years' time, there were two scans for Yates brothers.
Well, has anybody seen Simon Yates the last couple of weeks? Anyway, other
Adam
business.
Yates.
Adam Yates. Oh, God. Whoa. So yeah, easily done. But you're right,
you
Francois.
Win.
As we get to know them better, we get to know their differences, and I'm sure that will come as a great relief to them. In the any other business column, we have to talk about the controversy that's erupted once again over Team Sky. Second rest in a row that they have failed to hold a press conference. Now, some people think this is a sort of media storm in a teacup. Other people get very exercised by it. It is a tradition to hold, certainly for the yellow jersey, to hold a press conference on the rest day. Team Sky last week said it was a travel issue. There was a big transfer, so a lot of journalists wouldn't have been there on time. There wasn't that excuse this time, and I think it's poor because we do get Chris Froome every day after the stage, but it's very brief. There isn't really an opportunity to develop any questions or ask follow-up questions. You're allowed four or five questions. The point of a rest day press conference is to go into a little bit more detail about the race and about how it's going and about the rivals and etc. And when you think about the origins of the Tour de France, the relationship between the race was founded by a newspaper. It's always had a very close relationship with the written word, the written media. I think it's a great shame that relationship starts to break down. I think it's still the race needs it. The race needs the writing around it. But it's symptomatic of a wider trend where a lot of people in a lot of fields, not just cycling, not just sport, are circumventing the traditional media and putting out their own. They don't need the media in the way that they did.
Well, let's just clarify what Team Sky did yesterday, because they did have a media engagement of some kind, but it was only for broadcast media, a bit like the mix zone at the finish. Might be getting a bit technical for our listeners here, but just to explain, the mix zone is where all the broadcasters can go, and basically the athlete moves along the line, really, and more or less answers the same questions from each of the rights-holding broadcasters, and then the non-rights-holding broadcasters, and then radio, as they move along through the zone. And so what Team Sky wanted to do on the rest day was, rather than having the sort of formal press conference where Chris Froome and perhaps Dave Brailsford and some of the other riders sit at the top table and all the journalists gather down and the questions come one after the other, they just wanted to do a quick broadcast media interview opportunity, and that's what they said they were going to do. Now, then some written media journalists turned up and there was a bit of a standoff, we understand, between Dave Brailsford, the Team Sky principal, and a journalist from Cycling News called Barry Ryan. And there's been a little bit of history in the last week or so, because Barry Ryan's colleague Daniel Benson also had a bit of a run-in with Dave Brailsford in Chambéry. My take on this is, I agree with you, Richard, I think that not doing a yellow jersey press conference on the last rest day of the Tour, it's poor form, it sets a bad precedent for the future. But it also brings into question what the role of the media is on the Tour de France. Perhaps the teams do want to bypass all of us and only engage with us when it's on their terms. They want to release their own audio of their riders talking or ask their own riders questions. But what that robs the wider world of, I suppose, is any kind of questions about anything that might be controversial or there might be an incident in the race. And let's take today's stage as an example. John Degenkolb fronted up and spoke to the media afterwards. But another scenario could have been, he could have disappeared into the Trek Segafredo bus, and then Trek could have sent out a written statement saying, John Degenkolb said there's no problem between me and Michael Matthews and everything's hunky-dory and fine. Now, that may or may not be true, but it does kind of rob the race of some of its drama and some of its storylines. With regard to Sky and Cycling News, my sort of discomfort comes into it when the journalists start to become the centre of the story. I think at that point, really, we've lost sight of what's actually important. I do take the point that Team Sky have made a lot of noise over the years about being transparent and being open and answering questions, and this kind of siege mentality, if you like, and certainly having a poor relationship with a big and influential and important website doesn't reflect well on them, but I don't think it necessarily reflects terribly well on cycling news either. And I think, I mean, I've had, you know, ups and downs with Dave Brailsford and other people at Team Sky over the years. You know, in 2010, Dave Brailsford didn't speak to me at all year. Now, I didn't write a piece saying, oh, Dave Brailsford's not speaking to me, isn't this terrible? That was his right. He was upset with some things that I'd written. It took a year before we managed to sort of sit down like grown-ups and talk it through. We did that, and we've kind of rubbed along okay ever since. But I know I've said or written things that perhaps haven't been gone down terribly well with him. And, you know, occasionally he said, I think you're, you know, out of order there. But at least there's a kind of a, you know, a two-way relationship. And I think when you lose a two-way relationship, really, it's counterproductive. You learn nothing.
Can you remember 2012? The first tour they were trying to win, Team Sky, they were holding presses like in nice and fancy places, little tables with every rider available for whoever wanted to join in the table. It was friendly, it was good-natured, good-humoured, you know, everybody had what they wanted. Everybody could have a head-to-head interview with whichever rider. The riders found it much more, you know, interesting and you know, stressless, I mean, unstressful to do it this way, because what kind of friendly chat with a bunch of journalists. Well, you know, what's happened? What's happened since then, you know?
But Francois, even in 2010, their first tour, and Killian Kelly on Twitter reminded me of this today. I wrote about it in my book about Team Sky that year. They deliberately held a press conference at the start in Rotterdam at a time when the new journalists couldn't make it. They were avoiding the press on that occasion. Brailsford, for you know, he doesn't sometimes cope all that well with the pressure of the tour. But there's nothing new in this either.
But don't forget, Rich, in 2010, they were probably trying to avoid questions about Michael Barry, who, of course, had ridden for US Postal. Lance Armstrong was riding the tour, and there'd been all those stories about, you know, things were coming home to roost for Armstrong that week, that very weekend, with some publication of some stories in the American papers. They were trying to kind of avoid difficult questions. And on the eve of this tour, they held... Team Sky held their pre-race press conference on the Wednesday, which is really, you know, unprecedentedly early, I think. I mean, I can remember there's plenty of press conferences on Thursday and on Friday, but they were holding it this year on Wednesday. I don't know, were they anticipating lots of questions about Bradley Wiggins and his TUEs and how all of that reflects on Dave Brailsford and the team?
And what I mean, you know, I've been in this trade a long time, like you guys, maybe a little bit longer, even my old age. But it's so, you know, it's so unwise to act like this with the press, because if you give them the impression you're giving out propaganda and you're just going to disclose, tame statements or communiques with nothing in them, that's when you get the journalists excited. You know, they want blood, they want more. They'll go for, and if you don't talk to them face to face, they'll go run the back to talk to other guys, find different sources, and you're not doing your job well. The easiest way out of problems is to hold a press conference and say nothing.
The great irony here is that I think, I mean, that's the where I'm slightly divided, because these press conferences can often be a waste of time. But previous press conferences on rest days for Team Sky, they've sometimes been hijacked by questions about doping and suspicion and so on, which create a story without any real substance to it a lot of the time. The irony this year is that I think the questions would have been about the race, because the thing that people are actually talking about is the race and the closeness of the race. So I think it's a massive own goal. They have shot themselves in the foot this year with this.
They've been trying to create a second fire of in terms of communication, but by actually not talking about this at all, obviously, or Dave Brailsford's problems at all, obviously, and not even talking about Chris Froome. What you find on Twitter and on most communiques these last couple of days, it's all about Michal Kwiatkowski, if you talk, and it's true, Michal Kwiatkowski, that does a hell of a job for Chris Froome. This guy is a world champion, a Milan-San Remo winner, and he really, really works very hard for his leader. So you have lots of tweets about how, you know, dedicated he is and everything. And by putting, you know, his, all this dedication and hard work to the foreground, then we forget that there might have been a dispute between Mikel Landa and Chris Froome, and we forget that, you know, that there might be a little bit of a row between teams. At least that's what they are trying to do.
But just to clarify, I mean, this specific row between Dave Brailsford and Cycling News. I mean, on the one hand, Barry Ryan's piece that Brailsford appears to have reacted badly to was just a sound piece of remembering things that were in the public domain. I mean, there was nothing in there. Okay, you might not like the slant that it took, and I wouldn't expect Dave Brailsford to like the fact that it was focusing on all of the the more negative aspects of the fallout from the TUEs and the Parliamentary Select Committee and the UK anti-doping investigation and so on. But
even
the cycling podcast got a mention, yeah. But these are all things that are in the public domain, so it's really daft of Brailsford to take umbrage at a piece that's just reminding people of things that have happened over the last year. And there was, I mean, okay, it might have come from a particular angle. There might have been a bit of editorialising in Barry Ryan's piece, but, you know, that's not, you know, that's allowed as well. I think it was unwise of Brailsford to make a point of it, unwise to pick a confrontation with two journalists from the same media. But on the other side, Dave Brailsford's entitled to speak to whoever he wants. You know, he can pick the journalists he wants to talk
to.
Well,
I was going
to
say,
there are consequences to all of this,
of
aren't
course there are consequences. I mean, there is a history. I mean, you were talking today about Cyril Guimard, how terrible he was with the press. He played real games with the press. In football, Alex Ferguson didn't speak to the BBC for years. These confrontations, these run-ins do happen, and people in these positions do often behave in a very unwise fashion.
But it's the baggage of the sport as well, isn't it? Because it's only a decade or 15 years ago that Lance Armstrong and Johan Bruneel were operating their blacklist. They were controlling the media. They were picking and choosing, you know, more or less which journalists asked the questions. I mean, I remember the year when the press conference seemed to go from, you know, the microphone got handed around according to who Lance Armstrong wanted the microphone to be given to.
It was even worse than that. I mean, in the Lance Armstrong's days, the real press conferences, there were two during the tour, nothing to do with the press room or the press center of the tour. It was held at Lance Armstrong Hotel on the day he had chosen, and he was sending the invitations to a dozen journalists he had picked himself. At the time I was working for Reuters, who didn't want to speak to me, so we managed to have Stephen Farran, who is now with Cycling News, going to the press conference with us, because that's what we do. I mean, journalists, just to tell our listeners, a good way of getting around that is to say, you know, so, well, if you're in not on speaking terms with Dave Brailsford, then you find somebody else working for you who goes to Dave and says, well, you know, this guy, well, you know what he's like. I mean, you know, but you're my friend. I mean, we always find a way to have the good, you know, you say the good cop and the bad cop. I mean, in all with our media organizations, there's always a way, you know, to find the good guy who's getting on well. When I was working with Reuters, I was in charge of sports in France, and the guy in charge of football was not on speaking terms anymore with the press chief of the French national team. And I told him, you know, well, it's a professional fault, you know. You can't afford not to be on speaking terms with the press chief of the national team. Do something about it. Invite him to dinner. But, I mean, you do have to be friends with him, you know. It's a very strange game we're playing.
Well, listen, let's wrap things up for tonight. We'll probably return to this at some point. We might return.
Oh, no, we've solved it.
No, we might return to it in one of our sort of...
Maybe in the road trip part
the journey,
two.
The road trip part two.
When we can say what we really think.
we will say what we really think there. It's a Friends special. We released part one on Monday. We're recording ourselves as we travel around France. It's very off-piste. There's not a lot of cycling in there. But part one was released on Monday. There's a lot of slagging off of Lionel in it.
Well, I think
excellent.
The whole thing's been engineered to be...
That's the theme. That's the thread that runs through it.
Make me sound ridiculous.
But there's other stuff too. And
can I have a last word about our old friend,
sure.
Johan Ofredo, you know? Because Johan Ofredo, he's been with us. He's his first Tour de France at 30. He was one of our favourites. I mean, inside the second podcast team, to get a Pedro Deschamps jersey.
He's going to get one anyway.
Yeah. And And he's always so outspoken and, you know, and sincere. It's sometimes disarming. But today, he struggled a lot. He said that during the rest day he was sick, like Philippe Gilbert. There seems to be, might be a story there, you know, because, I mean, stomach problems seem to be spreading in the peloton. Hopefully they don't spread to the press as well. But there you are. Johan Alfredo said he'd lost 2 kilos during the rest day, which seems to be a lot, you know, so that might be a little bit of French exaggeration just there. So at the finish, he was there, you know, asked him how it went, and he said, terrible, I was, you know, and so that there was a journalist asking him, so I imagine you had lots of ups and downs today in this stage. He said, I didn't have any ups and downs, I was absolutely terrible from start to finish.
Well, another rider who's really suffering is Dan McClay. I mean, he was bad the day before, the rest day. I mean, again, must be something up with him. Really struggled through that. He's the Lanterne Rouge, last man overall. He was last over the line again today. Really hope he has a good night's sleep and a good meal and manages to get through the next couple of mountain stages, because it's turning into a bit of an ordeal for him, I think.
Sorry for tonight's very long podcast, but, you know, we had a rest day. Yes, it's a lot to catch up on. Don't look at me like that, man.
Well,
I'm just trying to wrap things up.
Most people won't have got this far, will they?
No, surely not. Surely not. Anyway, I was plugging a friend's scheme. Become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you to all those who've signed up recently. Hope you're enjoying our Tour de France coverage. Do leave a review on iTunes as well if you
fancy
it.
Or leave a review wherever you get your cycling podcast from.
Anywhere. Leave a review anywhere.
And if you don't like us, don't tell us.
And if you don't like us, don't leave a review anywhere. Anyway, that's all for tonight. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Francois, thank you.